Setting the stage here, and he's taking some of my slides, so we might. But we'll start, and my disclaimer is I'm not a soils person. I don't know anything about soils other than my trees grow in them. So, like my friend I ran into yesterday, he says, "What are you doing at this meeting?" And he told his wife I was here. She says, "Why is he here?" So I don't know why I'm here other than Graham twisted my arm. But, see, I added some co-authors so I can blame them for some of the things if I get them wrong here. And this is one thing I tell my students never, ever do in your entire career is put so much stuff on a slide nobody can read it. But I don't want you to read this slide. I want you to see the pattern here. I've been very fortunate that I've been able to work in Cypress Wetlands for 38 years. Starting in 1974 for my master's thesis at one site in Louisiana. And from there, I've grown to multiple sites. We're measuring productivity on across the southeast of the United States. And just this idea of what we've grown from in the 1970s when hardly anybody was looking at cypress swamps because nobody thought they were important. When I started at LSU, I went there for marine sciences, thinking I was going to be working in marine sciences. And the Louisiana Offshore Oil Report was being developed. Impact statement was being done. They had nobody to look at the cypress swamps in Louisiana because nobody knew anything about them. And nobody knew anything about them, but the pipeline was going to cross them. So they said, "Would you like to work in them?" I said, "Oh, okay. You're paying my way, so I guess I'll do what you want me to do." So from there, I have grown to what we have now. And what I would like to look at today is to start with is some of the patterns that we've seen in these swamps, talk about what we've seen in the past, what people have shown, and one of the things that we've shown is hydrology has a huge impact on what happens in these forested systems. And starting back in 79, Bill Mitch and Kathy Ewell working in Florida, looking at cypress stands going from cypress pines, which are the drier sites, and very low productivity to pure stands of cypress, which are growing in flooded sites, having low productivity. What they showed was that there's this pattern, drier and too much water, reduced productivity, but in these seasonally flooded impulse sites where you've got waters coming from the rivers or being input, you have higher productivity. A nice little bell-shaped curve for the cypress and for the all the trees, essentially. And Bill Mitch continued when he left Florida looking at the river discharge and had affects productivity of the trees, and looking at tree cores, and looking at how through time the trees along this river have a very nice correlation between river discharge, which is bringing in those nutrients and those flood pulse events, increasing the productivity of the systems, except for two time periods when he was looking at the thing. And in 1937 to 66 was the best fit for the tree growth versus discharge, but in 27 to 36, not so much. And that was related to, that was a period of heavy harvesting going on in the area. So a huge impact on the trees that were left. In 67 to 76 was a period of time when the beavers were moving in, damming up the river systems, causing increased flooding, which lowered the productivity of the systems. So you got when you're looking at these things, you got to consider all the factors that are going on and what impact it's going to have on tree growth in those areas. Sandra Brown working in Florida with H.T. Odom, looking at cypress domes and rivers where you would have sewage inputs into them, what impact that had on it. And what she found was the more phosphorus input that was going into these systems, the higher productivity. Again, related to hydrology, because it's mostly the flooding that's bringing the phosphorus into the systems and these little bit of swamps. So again, we keep harping on the fact of, hydrology. Hydrology is important in these areas. And we were still expanding our studies in Louisiana, and what we were finding in our sites was in these swamp systems where you had stagnant, continually flooded conditions occurring, mainly because of man impounding the swamp, you get very low productivity. And looking at sites in Louisiana, Florida, and other areas where you drain the swamps, the cypress swamps are having lower productivity. But in these nice riverine systems where you had seasonal flooding, again, higher productivity that was being found. Then I got started working with Pat McGonigal, who many of you know, and we were comparing sites in South Carolina. And he was at the Savannah River College layout versus the sites that we had in Louisiana looking at it. And what we were finding in those plots is there's not as much difference in the seasonally flooded sites and the drier, more upland sites. But what we were getting greatest impact is when we start getting more and more flooding in these sites, productivity declines. And the white dots are for sites that have been altered by man. What happens a lot in those cases is man does something, they put in a dam or put in a levee or a roadway or whatever. So you flood these sites rapidly. And when you flood a site, even the site responds rapidly versus the slow, like in Louisiana where you've got rising sea levels, so it's occurring slowly, or if you change it drastically, you get much less, much greater drop in productivity in those areas. So still, hydrology, you know, just pressing that idea that hydrology is important in these areas. And then another thing that came out, which is not quite as much related to hydrology, but you see a hydrology effect. Beth Middleton and Cameron Key published a paper looking at latitudinal changes in cypress swamps and leaf litter production. And they found a bell-shaped curve that they proposed, whereas the sites that are clear square are sites that have been altered hydrologically. So you see that even in those, looking at them that way, there is a hydrological effect in what happens to the productivity of these trees that are growing out there. And then when I moved to Clemson in 1990, the whole thing about sea level rise, global climate change, was sort of getting into the forefront of things that was going on. And what impact that was having on their forests and species that are growing in these tidal areas. And a number of studies that were done, and you can see in almost every instance of whatever factor you look at, from survival to germination capacity, when you increase the salt levels, seedling response declines. Almost everything that's been done early in it on is looking at greenhouse studies, looking at cypress seedlings, because it's a whole lot easier to work with the cypress seedlings in a greenhouse setting than it is to go out and measure a lot of these things in with the mature trees growing out in swamps. So, you know, we think this is how the trees will respond even in an adult stage, but you've got to remember that all these studies have been done with seedlings to start with. And because of what I was doing, having moved to Louisiana, and a number of sites, especially when you walk on PD and Santa Rivers over here, and work that I was doing in Louisiana still, I got involved with Ken. When the Global Climate Change Program, he and Tom Doyle approached me about going in with them to look at these tidal swamps, like Greg talked about. They're a very important resource that we knew absolutely nothing about hardly. And just what impact was salinity going to have on those areas. And what we did, in all these plots that we have, that I have shown all that data from that second slide from, is in most of these sites we have paired 20 by 25 meter plots that we've gone in and tagged and measure all the trees that are in those plots on an annual basis, at least. We also have put on many of the trees that growth bands that we can measure monthly. So some of the areas we go out every month and have been measuring those trees, and then all the trees get measured at least once a year. We have litter boxes in many of the sites, five boxes that we can measure that organic material that Greg was talking about that's being deposited on the forest floor and being decomposed or exported out to the system, and water level gauges that are recording hourly what's going on in those areas. So now we're starting to accumulate a lot of information. Like I say, I've got a lot of it here, and a lot of it I start to put together because when Graham approached me about doing this, I kept saying, well, I don't know anything about soils and nutrients. All I know is trees and how they're growing. And unfortunately, a lot of the data was in files on the computer that had never been looked at beyond this, putting it in the file. So, okay, we'll get to it eventually. So I had to spend most of the summer coming up with all those numbers to make those tables. So what we're going to start looking at is some of those trends, and I'm very fortunate having those long-term data sets that can start to look, because most of our graduate students that go through, you know, they collect a lot of the data, but our graduate students, if they're master's students, they get a year and a half of data. If they're a PhD student, we're lucky they get three. is what they're finding, what's typical for those areas. Can we simplify and use what they're finding to say, this is how these systems work? Okay, let's find out. This is one of the sites that we're working on. It's in Georgetown. Our institute is located on a 17,500-acre foundation property. That's a combination of forest and marshes, all different kinds. The neighborhood just adjacent to us donated 700 acres of land to Clemson, which has this nice swamp that runs through it. It used to be a flowing system that's now been cut off by roads north and south of it. So it's pretty much pounded rain-fed system. And we have plots in the swamp, central portion of the swamp, on the edge of the swamp, where it turns more into heartwoods and then along the pine stands above it. We're going to talk mainly about the swamp part of it today, and this is what it looks like. Yeah, it's mainly a black gum cypress situation that's, again, flooded by rainwater. We've been out there since 2000 through 2010. Top graph is the leaf litter being produced by those trees. Bottom graph is the stem growth based on the annual measurement. We measure every year so we can see how much biomass the tree is producing. Then we can put it on a stand basis. If you look at litter fall across the 11 years of study that we've done, it's not very variable. It hovers around 400 grams per square meter a year being added to the system. So you don't see much there. Again, look at the tree growth itself. South Carolina during this time from 1998 to 2002 was in drought, peaking in 2002. Tree growth was declining in all in those areas. 2003, we went back to pretty much normal rainfall for the year. Tremendous response by the trees for that increased moisture in the areas. The water levels hit and the swamp itself, according to our water measurements, dropped about 4 feet below the soil surface during the peak of the drought. Back to normal, which meant it was flooded for about 40, 50 centimeters during most of the year. Trees responded. This is very similar to what Bob Keelan and Joy Young found in a study that they did looking at the impact of a road on cypress swamps. When they put a road in and impounded the swamp behind it, the trees the first few years right after that responded and grew much more, and then they declined for the long-term response. So it had an immediate response to that water input, but then declined. You see these again starting to decline. We had another drought in 2007 in South Carolina, and we're in the midst of another drought occurring. Yeah, so it seems like the tree growth itself is responding very well to changes in the water availability in these systems. Hydrology plays a very important role. And if you know, we had a student that was studying, a master's student that was looking at this area as part of the study in 2001. What numbers he got showed very low productivity in the system. So if he'd been studying in 2003, it would have been a very productive system. So, even with 11 years of data, I almost hesitate to say, what's the average for out here? Is it going to keep responding back and forth? So lots of changes that occurred. Hopco itself, like I said, 17,500 acres of land, little wetlands, see the blue-gray colors. We're going to concentrate on two of them. The upper one is we call Crab Hall Swamp. It's mainly a cypress tupelo wetland. When I went there in 1990, 1991, 92, this area never drained. It was flooded the entire time I was there, so I thought that was a normal for the systems. A little depressional wetland, fed by rainfall, and then we get into the droughts. The drain, they go 5 feet below the surface. Big difference. The lower yellow box is Tarkill Swamp. It's mainly a water tupelo cypress swamp. Very nice, beautiful systems. Nice also being close because you can get to them in a few minutes, get in and out. Makes it nice. And we have a data set for those swamps from 1991 to 2010. It's an ongoing study. We have measured those trees on a monthly basis for the entire time period. We have water level data for that entire time period. We have litter fall for that entire time period. What we don't have is the soils and nutrients. Right. Anyway, again, looking at the litter fall,
You know, from 1991 to 2004, it's fairly uniform. It doesn't fluctuate that much. The thing is really getting you, when I plotted these data, I'm trying to see what's going on. What happened in 2005 and 2007 and 2009? I wonder. And we know the drought was in 2007. And that had an impact. But it really wasn't that dry in 2009 or 2005. What happened earlier on? Then we got this period from 96 to 2004. You know, if you did a study right here, you might think that's pretty normal for these systems. But things are happening.
These are some of the questions that we're going to have to ask ourselves and trying to pull up more data now and see what factors are related to all these variations that we have seen. Then I want to look at a site in Louisiana. There's Lake Brett, which is down below Baton Rouge, close to the Chaplain Basin. It's over here. It's a little airy because it's so bright you can't see it. But what we're having here is we have a finger of bottomland hardwood protruding out into the swamp. And in the 1980s, we were approached by a landowner in the area saying, "My trees are dying. What's going on out here?" being in Louisiana, we sort of knew what the problem was. The land was subsiding. The water levels were going up. So we were getting more water in the area. That was the hypothesis, anyway. So we went out in 1984 and put plots in, and we looked at it across a gradient going from dry to wet. Green is the swamp, the more cypress area. The blue is more hardwoods with a few cypress scattered in. I put all three of these because I wanted to show you what's happening. And the thing that we've seen in that one, again, it started out, it was not that much difference. We had a huge variation occurring in this time period. Hurricane Andrew hit in 1992. Boom, we lost a bunch of trees and drier intermediate plots. Cypress, we didn't lose much at all, but it's also an area that has a lot of ash and maples are coming in. Those are the ones that we lost most of. So it hit a huge drop, especially in the drier and intermediate sites, but not so much in the cypress swamp areas. Sort of further along for a few years, and then all of a sudden you start getting a huge increase in the drier sites. And this huge jump in productivity for that site is due to Chinese talc, the basic, which has not been there prior to the hurricane. It came in, and these trees are all 10 centimeters or greater, so we call it tree. You know, and so it's not counted until it gets to that stage. We can see the talus coming in and growing from the measurements that I've said. The talus were growing up to an inch to 2 inches in diameter a year. And by this time, entering into the stage, it already started to produce seeds, started reproducing the understory. So we went in after about 10 years after the storm, that growth starts to decline or level off. Hurricane Ivan came in. 2004, 2005, we got hit, double whammy there, climbed, but not as much as with the first storm, and then just off here a couple of years ago. So we got these growth rates, hurricane recovery, hurricanes recovery, a little bit hurricanes again. Lots of things going on out there. And if you look by 2008-09, the productivity of the trees in those areas are almost identical. So why is that? I don't know. Another thing to look at. But getting back to the salinity part, which is what we're supposed to be talking about. I'm almost through here. Get back to the salinity. So one of the things that we knew when I moved to South Carolina was that is the slide that Greg showed for tidal forest. The greatest amount of tidal forest is in South Carolina. Lots of nice rivers, lots of nice floodplain forests. Tidal signature extends for 40, 50 kilometers upstream. So we've got lots of areas that are being affected by this tide. And then as sea level rises, what you expect is the salt to move upstream. And you start to see the depth of the trees. And what you expect in a lot of cases is the migration of these forests further upslope as water levels rise. But we were very interested in what was going on there.
Then you got to consider, too, you know, we talk about tidal effects. There are many different kinds of tides, many different things that are going on. This is one of the figures from the book that Greg referred to that Tom Doyle put together in this chapter. And you can see that going from this point. part of the coastal areas, you've got the twice a day tides, which can be up to 3 meters in variation from one of the high. Coming around into Louisiana, where you've got a once a day tide, which could be anywhere from 1 foot to 3 foot type thing. So you've got once a day, twice a day, a mixture, sometimes equal two tides a day, or unequal two tides a day, or to one tide a day. So you've got a lot of different variations of things that are going on there. And a lot of the tidal systems that we have in this part of the coast that we're looking at, you also got to consider there's a huge man impact in those areas. A lot of those tidal forested wetlands are cut off from the tide. And it's more wind generated than it is tidal. So you got that to look at, and you got the big tides on the east coast to look at. But anyways, let's go on to what we're looking at. Some of the same sites that Greg is using are the ones that we're using. The Waccamaw and the Sanford River and Savannah River areas. We have plots set up in those areas that we're looking at. We have the monthly bands, the litter fall, the annual tree growth. We have one student, like I said, has looked at the marsh production and is at least roughly doing some clip plots out there to see how it changes through time. It does vary from year to year, and it does vary from species from year to year because of the changes that are occurring. Greg started off showing you the Savannah River from the river edge. I'll show you from the interior. So this is the upper fresh sites where you got the 0.1 parts per thousand. The middle site, you can start to see more of the herbaceous stuff coming in there as the canopy opens up and the sunlight hits, allowing that to open. And then getting down to the lower edge where you've got the average 3 parts, 4 parts per thousand. Getting dead trees, dying trees. Some of the sites that we're looking at are the 20 cypress trees that we banded. We're down to 6 trees surviving after 6 years. So we're losing trees there. Just to give you a little better idea of the variations in salinity at these sites, this is 2005 to 2009, the Waccamaw and Savannah. You can see the fresh sites, there's not very much variability there. We don't expect to see any salt there. They're far enough upstream never to see salt, hopefully for the near future. Then we've got the middle sites, the open circles. You see on the Savannah sites, it's much lower than it is on the Waccamaw River. Savannah is a much larger river, much more discharge coming down the river. Whereas when you get up to the Waccamaw River here during those dry periods of time, 2007 was a drought. You can see even the middle site, the salinity of those jumped up to be as high as it was at higher impact sites. It's been that way pretty much since then. So we do have some variations in salinity there. And what we're finding is that, yes, that salinity, as you increase, by the time you get up to probably about 1.8 parts per thousand, the basal area of the forest, which can be up to 80 square meters per hectare in the fresher sites, has dropped below 40. So even that, and what had been proposed by,
mine just went blank, Wilmington, Courtney Hackney, was
at 2 parts per thousand, you start to see stress in these cypress trees. And you can see, by the time you get up to 1.8, 2 parts per thousand, you start to see severe changes in the basal area and in forest height in those areas.
And I want to throw the band data in just to show you how
it looks when you do that. So I worked up one of these for 2006 and 2009, 3 growing seasons. And what you see in almost every forest that I worked in with the bands is the trees start to grow, depending on where you are. Where we are, it starts about May, early May, or mid-May, and then by July, 1st of August, they've stopped growth, the diameter growth of the trees. And then it sort of levels off through the dormant season, and then it picks up, levels off. What you see is in the salt impacted sites, there's not as much growth in those sites occurring through time. They are growing, but in the long term, it's not going to be very sustainable out there. Probably, especially in the sites with trees dying and dropping out, eventually it's going to drop to zero. And even at the lower levels, we're seeing an impact in those sites.
Sister Lindsay has a huge, has an impact on growth rates of the trees out there. And
looking at the basal area, one of the things that you see is with the hydrology, you can look at hydrology in terms of how long it's flooded, how deep it's flooded, and season of flooding, frequency of flooding. This is looking at hours per year that it's flooded. You know, we're going back to those original graphs that we showed that the longer the area is flooded, the less productivity, the most productive the trees are. Which is interesting, of some of these signs for us are the ones that are almost flooded year round. So even there is some variability even in those. And looking at the flood frequency, the number of floods per year, what we're getting is these sites here are the sites that are lower on the river, closer to the ocean, so they're being flooded more and more by that strong tidal fluctuation. So in those areas, you would expect salinity to be increasing too also.
So you throw that salinity factor in there, and then the graph that goes back to Greg showed is the S. And if you look at the mean basal layer increment of those trees, as salinity increases, by the time you get to 4 parts per thousand, it's pretty much down to nothing. And so we're eventually losing those trees. And going back to the glitter fall, the thing I wanted to stress about the glitter fall is different from what he's stressing about the glitter fall. Because I actually did have that nutrient slide in there also, and I threw it out. And I'm glad I did. But the thing that I wanted to talk about, he talked about the amount of glitter in the fresher sites and salts. And there's a lot less being added. But one of the things that Mark Brinson in 1985, probably the first study on tidal forests that was ever done, that reported about productivity and its impacts on salinity, was he found that salinity caused the litter to fall earlier in the year, which may have an impact on the nutrients like Greg was talking about, because the greener haven't had that time to move back from the leaf to the tree before it fell. So you're getting a greater input of nutrients to the system. But what we're finding, if you look, the peak litter fall pattern is the same all the way across for all the sites. So it's not changing the seasonality of the fall through time, which is different from what had been reported by Mark. And that whole thing about the latitudinal differences has irked us for a long time. Because, I'm working in these systems, and they're working up in South Carolina and North Carolina. Our swamps are very, very productive. So how do they fit in on that downward curve? So I plotted all of our stuff that we're doing and took out all the salt ones, because they won't have that factor in there, and Ken plotted it up for me. And look at that litter fall, which is what Beth looked at. And we don't have that strong bell-shaped curve that she had on. We do have a little help there. But what we need to do now is to go back and look at the natural systems versus those that have been impacted by man. If we take out a bunch of these sites that are all impounded, permanently flooded sites with low productivity, then what does that do to the curve? So I think we're going to flatten that curve out and show that there's not that much difference in latitudinal differences there. If you look at the stem wick production, see it's much more variable, and there is really no curve there to show for that. All right. Graham said he wanted some take-home points.
So, if nothing else, any of my students get out without saying that swamp productivity is closely tied to hydrology, without saying that it's closely tied to hydrology, he's going to not get out. long-term studies. We need those long-term studies. And I say, all of our graduate students are getting 1 to 3 years of data. Is it truly representative of what's going on in the systems? Fortunately, we are collecting some longer-term data sets now. We're building on graduate students. They start a project, we continue it. Just keep picking it up. Climate seems to have a much greater impact on the stem productivity than it does the litter fall productivity. And interesting, change my numbers here. We'll go back. The cypress can tolerate fluctuations in salinity for short periods of times, but constant 2 parts per thousand seems to be a change in their response. But you know that if you drive in any of these systems crossing the rivers, you'll see live cypress trees growing in areas you know get salt water. So they can tolerate it for short periods of time, and it gets flushed out by the water. Leaf litter fall decreases the salinity, as does basal area. the timing of tree growth and leaf fall does not seem to be as much
different in the sites across the Salinity gradient as Mark had originally expressed in his thing. Studies like this could not be done without a huge number of people. Through time, let's say 38 years, I've had the very fortunate chance to work with many co-investigators that a lot of them I'm still working with today. Field assistants are greatly appreciated. Those guys and girls have done a tremendous amount of legwork over the years. Grad students that we've had, some are in this room. Funding has been through a variety of sources. It's always a hunt for money. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to continue this for at least another 4 or 5 years before I retire. And somebody will pick it up after that. But that's where I am.